Hello, I'm Dominic Green. I'm Life and Arts Editor of Spectator USA. And welcome to our weekly Life and Arts podcast. This week, I'm casting the pod with Sir Roger Scruton, the Knight of the Living Philosophers. But he's not just a philosopher. He also writes widely and well on subjects ranging from wine to Wagner and fox hunting to fiction. And this week, I've travelled to Scrutopia, his farm in Brinkworth, Wiltshire. Scruton now has not one, not two, but three books coming out. The Philosopher has Conservatism, An Invitation to the Great Tradition. The Music Critic has a collection, Music as an Art. And the Fiction Writer has Souls in the Twilight, a collection of short stories. Roger Scruton, welcome to Spectator USA.
Thank you for inviting me. Most extraordinary thing to be addressing Spectator USA. Don't know what they'll make of you, but there you are.
You're a prolific writer. You have several books on the blocks at the moment. Is that necessity or compulsion?
I don't think of myself as prolific as all that. Some books I write by necessity. The little book on conservatism, which has just come out in America, I wrote by necessity because the publisher offered me an advance for it. And that was, once you've taken the advance, there is then the obligation to fulfill your part of the deal. So I did that, and I enjoyed that. But the other books, in particular the book of stories, those are stories I've been working on over the last 10 or 15 years, just every now and then returning to them. Just five stories which contain my observations of the world in which we are and the very volatile world in which we are. And finally they came together as a little group called Souls in the Twilight. And my American publisher, Beaufort Books, said they'd like to publish them. So I'm really pleased about that.
Do you see a connection between the way that a short story might emerge and the way that ideas might emerge when you're writing about, say, politics or about music?
That's actually a very interesting question. In the British and, I suppose, American tradition, we tend to compartmentalise people's thinking and writing, you know, that I would be a professional philosopher writing about this, or an essayist writing about that. And the idea of adding fiction to that would be regarded as a kind of a digression. But I belong much more to the sort of continental way of thinking. In particular, you know, I suppose my first efforts in self-discovery occurred in France, where a true intellectual does not make a distinction between philosophy on the one hand and literature on the other. And there is a continuity between all these things, and I'm the same. I don't see my philosophical and political ideas as developing in some abstract, arcane arena, isolated from everyday life. On the contrary, I see them as reflections on the life that I've known and the life that I've lived and the life that I've observed in others. And all of this is bound up with the language that I use. And I use it in order to embrace reality and convey not just what I think about it, but what it feels like. And it's the feel of the world in which we are, which to me is the most important object of writing.
The feel of reality that you describe in your philosophical essays comes across very clearly. And in my limited reading in the field, that is quite unusual. How did you arrive at this very clear way, this very real way of expressing yourself?
Well, that's nice of you to say that. I suppose by hard work.
Well, yeah.
and by taking literature seriously. I was very impressed as a young boy, or teenager, by Jean-Paul Sartre, this philosopher who also wrote novels and plays and so on, and tried to use the French language to express how it was for him to be Sartre in that post-war period, coming to grips with the society which had collapsed all around him. And it was an object lesson for me. And I thought, you know, that's how one should write. One should be working hard to get the right words and to present a clear picture of where you are writing from and whom you are addressing. And there are philosophers who've done this, you know, in our tradition, but mostly they don't get onto the curriculum somehow. But in his own way, Bertrand Russell had a bit of that. He certainly had clarity of a kind and a sense of the beauty of words. But he was writing from a position of patrician disdain towards the ordinary life around him, and in particular the life of those people who had the ghastly business of governing things.
Russell was, of course, a great explainer of different philosophical principles and positions. We tend to think, as a shorthand, to think of the French as being great explainers and definers of their principles. There's also the idea of the commonsensical streak in English, meaning you never quite have to define your principles. The emergence of conservatism, as what the French would have called an ideology in the 19th century, seems to have been a very erratic, unplanned development, and it seems to have been something which has been hard to define subsequently. When you're writing the conservatism book, which is coming out now, what are the first principles, the identifying characteristics, which you're identifying after the effect, in a way?
Well, that's a, yes. You're absolutely right that conservatism emerged over a century as a kind of qualification of what all those overexcited intellectuals were saying. You know, the great liberal individualist social contract idea had burst upon the world in the 18th century. Well, I suppose the 17th, if you take in Locke. Become the ruling principle of political reform, justifying everything, including the French Revolution. And conservatism was a kind of point of hesitation introduced by those who were wise enough to see how dangerous this idea is and how it threatened not just the institutions that we've inherited, but the culture, the way of being, and the peaceful relations between people that previously had prevailed. And I think in the 19th century, people began to articulate this. People, obviously, Burke in the late 18th century was the great founder of this tradition, but people like Chateaubriand in France, and later Ruskin and others in Britain, began to recognise that abstract theories in politics look very nice on paper, but they don't actually describe real people. And real people exist immersed in their social condition, not reflecting on it. And that kind of social immersion requires great delicacy to perceive and also certain robust honesty to defend. And I think that's, as people began to do that, they gradually emerged a conservative vision, which became articulate in the 20th century with people like Oakeshott and the Austrian school and so on. But Hegel, who was a great conservative, expressed the point really rather well in the preface to The Philosophy of Right, that, as he's put it, the owl of Minerva flies only with the dusk. You know, that people understand these things only when they're losing them. And that is one of the great sort of tragic thoughts that underlies conservatism in our tradition.
You are casting conservatism then as emerging as an antithesis to the triumphant liberal individualism of the 18th century.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you feel that that looks more clear to us now because we're in a moment then of twilight?
Well, that's interesting. I think it does. We can look back on all this. No thinking person looking back at the 19th century will fail to take into account what followed, and what followed in particular because of the excited ideas that people then were playing with, in particular Marxism and the reaction to Marxism and the vivid nationalism that arose in Central Europe. And certainly we are very aware of that ideas in the wrong heads become extremely destructive, and that the role of the intellectual ought not to be the role assumed in the 20th century of guiding the whole of mankind towards some utopian future, but ought to be the opposite of that, of reflecting on where human beings are going and offering gentle advice, which of course is not something that intellectuals usually have the modesty to do.
The United States was founded in a fit of idealism, and it has this utopian streak, which, as you're saying, seems inimical to a conservative point of view. But of course, the United States has developed its own quite distinct conservative thinking. And it came to it relatively late, in the sense of it being formulated perhaps in the 1950s.
Yes. Well, that's a very interesting observation. I do reflect on this. If you look back at the American Constitution, I think the first thing that strikes you, first thing that strikes me anyway, is that it isn't utopian. There isn't a description of some ideal future that we're progressing towards. All of it is backward-looking. It's all saying, look, we've inherited this culture of rights. We have a legal order that we wish to perpetuate. And here are the principles under which we should be governed. And these principles tell us exactly how far government can go and no further. So it is very much not putting the government in charge of things to change the order of the world, but rather limiting it so that it preserves those things in our ordinary life that we value. And I think that's a very much, many people would say there's that conservative thought buried in the heart of the American Constitution, and it's why it has survived so well and adapted to changing circumstances rather than trying to take control of circumstances.
It's often seemed to me that if you take the Constitution of the United States and fold it in half, you'll find yourself looking at almost two documents. The earlier clauses, the ones complaining, for instance, about the king failing to honour his end of the deal, these are couched in the language of customary law, while the later ones are looking forward in the language of natural rights, which is an open-ended process of discovery. Does this contribute to the dynamism of American conservatism and its forward-looking aspect? Because European conservatism generally has this ideal of the church and the throne, which is viewed from the 18th century onwards as a retrospective idea, while the kind of radical individualism that comes to the fore in economic life in America seems to be very much compatible with American understandings of conservatism.
Yes, well, that's that's probably true, all that. Continental conservatism in the 19th century did have the church and throne emphasis. That is true, because those were the institutions which enabled people to articulate what was not part of the great political and economic changes. But if you look at the British case, I think you'll see it's rather different, that conservatism in the 19th century here, as an intellectual movement, went hand in hand with socialism, for at least for a lot of the time, in the writings of Ruskin. You know, it's hard to distinguish Ruskin from Morris sometimes. It was all about the ordinary person and the bewilderment and the loss and the alienation of the ordinary person under the rule of the new big economy, and how to preserve intact the networks of support that such people needed, and to amplify those networks of support so that society did not fall apart. The church was obviously part of it for someone like Ruskin, not for Morris. Although the interesting thing is that Morris's aesthetic was entirely Gothic, you know, wouldn't have had any meaning without the church. But anyway, the Christianity at least was part of it for Ruskin, and that was only reasonable because after all it was a Christian community that he was talking about. And indeed, for all the changes, European communities at the level of ordinary people still are Christian communities. They've inherited that overarching conception of what human destiny is, and nothing else has been put in the place of it.
Of course, de Tocqueville noted the local differences between Christian society in Europe and in America in the 1830s, just at the point, really, that conservatism was becoming an ism. They are very different societies. Do you think that someone like, say, Joseph de Maistre, who's so interested in Isaiah Berlin, does someone like that have something to offer to Americans now compared, say, to Edmund Burke?
No, obviously Burke has a kind of authority, an ability to transcend his own conditions, which makes him available to everyone. You know, the Americans, the French can read him with pleasure and profit. De Maistre is fixated on that one great event, the French Revolution. Not that Burke didn't have an awful lot to say about that, but it's how to undo that great event, which he thought saw as the devil's work. That's De Maistre's position. And, of course, it doesn't carry a great deal of persuasion now, even though hiding within Maistre's writings is a very coherent conception of what a political constitution should be. Yes, he doesn't travel easily into the modern world. On the other hand, he wrote brilliantly, and that did give him an enormous influence at the time.
Of course, American conservatives, like British ones, they tend to look back towards a revolution that worked rather than one that led into tyranny.
Obviously, the Glorious Revolution in Britain and the American Revolution were both conducted in the same spirit of an attempt to return politics from a position of random tyranny to one of accountability to the people. That was what it's all about. And the common law, which is still our prevailing social institution, is about accountability. Establishing accountability is something that requires a culture and a huge effort. It's about introducing accountability into all human relations, contract, tort, crime, etc. It becomes a matter of finding who is responsible and transferring the cost to him. And our system of government is that. And we are Democrats, the Americans and the British in particular, in the sense that we regard everybody in high office as accountable to the people beneath him. That's very different from the French sort of dirigiste position, in which the people are accountable to the ones who govern them. You know, or not entirely, but, you know, there's a lot of that in it. And we see that in events as they unfold in France.
Are you concerned about how that accountability is going in Britain and in the United States as well?
Yeah, one's always concerned about it. Obviously, politicians try to avoid accountability. And one of the reasons why I personally objected to the European Union, at least in its more grandiose projects, was that it was an attempt to avoid accountability. It produces institutions where accountability is lost in the corridors of the system. Our local politicians were able to use it, that to get out of their obligations, by saying, well, you know, we're not free to change that law. We're not free to pass a law about this. This has all been expropriated from us by the great glorious institutions of the EU. The default position of humanity is tyranny. And in the modern world, tyranny moderated by bureaucracy. And I don't, as you see it in Russia as well, a kind of criminal-free economy run by criminals added to that. That's Russia and China. Top-down government by criminals with a free economy that they themselves control. And that works, and it will go on working forever, but it will eliminate the soul from the communities in question, as it is doing. And we are very lucky in Europe and in America that we escaped from that in the course of the Middle Ages and produced something infinitely more noble.
Do you find, turning now to Souls in the Twilight, the story collection, do you find the advantages of being able to address these questions in fiction versus tied to the real world?
Well, I think it's very important to understand the motives of ordinary people, how it feels to be an ordinary person in the world in which we live, what things attract us, what things draw us on, and what things repel us, what things give rise to resentment and distress. And you know, one of my stories is about a boy, an immigrant of Algerian origins, who has a burden of revenge because, in fact, his mother came originally from Palestine. He's inherited all that that sense that there is an unpaid debt that he himself has to pay. And it's a description of just what it's like to be that kind of person. Growing up in England, a pop music fanatic, absolutely obsessed with Oasis, but also being captured by a network of people who decide to use him in order to commit a political crime. And, you know, I tried to get into the psychology of this guy, and I really found it fascinating to be him for a bit and to see exactly what it is for such a boy to be part of this community. What is it in him that could be brought out and attached to the things that he really needs to be attached to rather than to those old dead things which are going to kill him? So my story is a little bit... That's just one of them, but that's the kind of thing that interests me. And I feel that when it comes on that particular question, when it comes to our politicians trying to deal with the influx of Muslims and the second and third generation Muslims, it's a lack of imaginative awareness of their position, which is partly hampering them from including them in the democratic order, and that imaginative awareness is one thing that I think fiction writers are obliged to put before them.
Would you see yourself being in the tradition of novelists of ideas, which in the English language or British literature, it's really quite a short list, isn't it? It's Aldous Huxley or Iris Murdoch.
I mean, they are such major figures. Well, in my novel that's published by Beaufort Books, Notes from Underground, I do try to put myself completely in the position of a young boy in the old Czechoslovakia, in the communist Czechoslovakia, and I did get his experience. I try to get it absolutely right because it just fascinated me that. And the ideas were all part of it because, yes, he saw in the world of ideas the escape from the dreariness and the emptiness of the world in which he found himself. That the world of ideas there was also a dissident world, one that was trying to define a genuine political order in the imagination, so to speak. So there, I really do deal with ideas up to a point. But never did the ideas interest me more than the characters. The heroine of that book, Betka, is the person who really interested me.
Would you describe yourself as a dissident?
Well, it seems that I am. I never intended to be. All I do is think what I think is true, and I try and work out what it is that the world is for me, and it turns out that I say and write is not approved by the establishment. On the other hand, the establishment, as it now is represented by, say, the BBC or whatever, is so inarticulate, so without foundations in any real tradition of philosophical or religious thinking, that you can't respect it. You can't think that, you know, not to be a dissident would be a betrayal of one's position.
In that desert of intellectual and aesthetic failure, do you still see music as being an oasis?
Well, yes. That's one of the wonderful things that we have, the especially the tradition of classical music, and going down into its offshoots in jazz and the musical and opera and all the rest. And there is a serious education involved in our musical tradition. It's one of the... If I was asked, you know, what do I think is the greatest achievement of Western civilization, I would not say science. I would acknowledge the Christian religion. I would acknowledge the Roman law and the common law. But I'd also say the classical tradition in music is what distinguishes our civilization from all others. And the absence of such a tradition is part of why Islam is so gloomy. It doesn't have that open, experimental approach to what is, after all, a product of the human soul.
You coined the phrase, I believe, downstream from Christianity, to describe the present position of the Western societies. Classical music tradition itself is downstream from Christianity in the sense that it pulled away from the church and emerged as a secular popular form in the 19th century.
Yes. I think almost everything that we have began life in the church, because that's the church was the first, as it were, the moment of creation of our civilization, and thanks to church polyphony, all those harmonic discoveries were made in the Renaissance and late medieval period in the Renaissance, which led to the orchestra, the string quartet, and so on. And yes, as you say, it secularized itself, but all the great composers remained religious in their hearts, you know, however far they were from the institutions of the church. I've just been writing about Wagner's Parsifal, for instance. You know, there was a man who didn't believe in God, but for whom the Christian inheritance was so important that he had to put it into artistic form and produced this extraordinary work of art. And I think, even without the religious side of it, our musical tradition expresses a vision of community which is unique. Our musical tradition is polyphonic. I say it means that it aims to create a harmony from individual voices which are doing completely different things. It's a symbol of what our political order is. Our political order is an order of free individuals who cooperate and harmonise. It's not an order of imposed uniformity. And of course, in Islamic music, insofar as there is any, that the basis is unison, a unison singing or unison playing. And even if they've tried to take over orchestras and so on, it's largely to play in unison. And I think that's an important symbolic difference. And by learning music as we know it, children do learn how to relate to each other in this free but harmonious way. And one of the things that I most regret, actually, is that people have ceased to organise choirs in primary schools, that music is put low down the curriculum always. Even our music faculties cease to teach harmony and counterpoint as the centre of things.
So when you talk, as the title says, music as an art, you're talking about art in the broadest social sense, as in the tradition of Ruskin.
Absolutely. Ruskin was not, as far as I know, particularly musical. But, I would is a difficult question. I would like to say that music is two things. It's something that you make, and it's also something that you listen to. And when you listen to it, of course, you are listening to someone making music, but it is an object of attention of the most exacting but pleasurable kind, which teaches you to stand back from the human world, to stand back and attend to what's going on. And when you are making music, you are at one with other people in a completely open and free way, which there is no other real example, although perhaps playing a sport in a team has something in common with it. But there you are able to depart on directions of your own. When you're playing in a chamber ensemble, you are not only completely free, but completely controlled. And this idea of order, which is freedom, and freedom which is control, is something which I think is deeply implanted in our civilization and very difficult to understand otherwise.
It does remind me of horse riding, which is something you've written about as well.
Yes, it has something in common. I think the world without music would be, for me, a very depressing world. But with music, it's transformed completely. And those people who are able to improvise or to sing as they work, to keep themselves going in whatever way through music, do exist in a higher realm, I think.
Do you feel that in our present time they may be whistling in the dark, in the sense that we have a great deal of music, but most of it's not very good, it's very fragmented, it's pestering us?
This is true, that there's a great difference between listening to music and overhearing it. And most music now is just overheard, and it's even if it's going on in those little things in your ear. And most pop music is composed of standardised phrases, three chords, idiot words, just repeated time and again. And of course, that is, if you like, an obliteration of music. It's closing the door to music.
Roger Scruton, thank you for taking the time to talk today.
Thank you very much.
My name's Dominic Green. I'm Life and Arts Editor of Spectator USA, and you've been listening to me, Casting the Pod, with Sir Roger Scruton, talking philosophy, music, fiction, art and religion. Join us next week for another Life and Arts podcast here on Spectator USA. Until then, thank you for listening, and goodbye.